All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and you had a test last time. You're getting them back in lab. And let's see, it is May 4th, and we're going to finish up the cardiovascular chapter today and then move on to respiratory chapter. And so I think we're just going to get started finishing up. Oh, we got an announcement. Somebody left a calculator in lab. It was a Thursday lab. Somebody left the calculator in Thursday's lab. So, no, if not, then give it to me after class and I'll take it up to the division office and the secretaries will hold it there for a little while. And then if nobody claims it, it will go over to Lost and Found. Where is Lost and Found at? It says security, right? It's campus security.
I have lab on Thursday. I sit with her.
Oh, okay. You're going to take it? That's fine. That's great. All right. So we have 5 lecture sessions left. So we're going to finish up cardiovascular, maybe get into respiratory, 1, 2, renal physiology. So it's looking like we're going to have chapters 14, 16, and 17 on the last test. But stay tuned. Maybe I'll have more on the last test. But you guys always come back after the class and ask me for more. So I'm torn. All right, so let's finish up cardiovascular. You see on the slide right here, we were talking about 3 important hormones that help regulate blood pressure, since we're talking about cardiovascular system. They also help regulate electrolyte balance, which when we get into the renal system, we'll talk a little bit about. But since this is cardiovascular, all right, we should never forget, what is blood flow? What's blood flow? What's the units of blood flow? It's a volume per time, right? So milliliter per minute, okay? And what is the very basic, simple equation for blood flow? It's going to be one thing over another. It is? Yeah, pressure divided by the resistance to that flow. That's going to equal blood flow, all right? But you also know something else, cardiac output. What are the units of cardiac output? Milliliters per minute. Did I hear stop calling it that? Milliliters per minute. Okay, and how do you measure cardiac output? That's equal to what physiologic parameters? Heart rate times stroke volume. Usually I say stroke volume times heart rate. I don't care which way you have it. It doesn't matter, right? But it's just kind of in my mind like that. That might be an important teaching point. All right, but what else is immediately obvious now? What can you tell me about blood flow and cardiac output? They're exactly the same. Okay, so we're going to use these equations in a little bit. So don't forget them. I'm going to leave them up on the board for right now. All right, so we were talking about these hormones, and we're going to finish that up. We got done talking about antidiuretic hormone. All right, and what's the basic idea with antidiuretic hormone? Does it help preserve water, or does it help you lose water? Preserve water in your body. So what happens to blood volume as you retain water? It goes up, venous return goes up, right? Cardiac output goes up. And so blood pressure has a tendency to be maintained by antidiuretic hormone. All right, we were in the throes of talking about the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Okay, so that is this slide right here. This is where we left off. And on this slide right here, you see how important the kidneys are for helping regulate the cardiovascular system. And this right here is the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure. All right, so if somebody has hypertension, something in this mechanism right here is misbehaving so that somebody is decompensating. So if we're going to develop treatments for hypertension, which is a good thing, because what's always the end result of uncontrolled hypertension? Death, okay? So, which is not a good thing. We don't ever want to face that, right? So we need to treat hypertension. So we want to interrupt or somehow adjust this mechanism one way or another. So we put a number of different pharmacologic agents on this slide to help you understand and appreciate this mechanism right here. So now, where should we take? Should we go over from the beginning, this mechanism, one more time? Okay. There are a number of steps, some enzymes, and some hormones involved in the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. So when you see the title right here, you should know which one of these active participants are enzymes and which ones are hormones. Remember, an enzyme facilitates the rate of a chemical reaction, and a hormone is a signaling molecule. They do inherently a little bit different thing. All right, so this is a response loop, which is characterized by all the different steps that you learned about. The first step of a response loop is a stimulus, and the last step is a response, and the response is going to interact with the stimulus to where you understand feedback. Right, so how would you relate the stimulus and response if it's negative feedback? They do what? They cancel or they subtract from each other, right? And if it's positive feedback, the stimulus and response add to each other, driving the system farther and farther away from homeostasis or the set point. Okay. So here is the stimulus, decrease in blood pressure, which means that there's going to be a decreased blood flow to the kidneys. Right, and it's very harmful to the kidneys because they need oxygen. It's a highly metabolic organ. And there's a certain part of the kidney that we learned about in anatomy called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. It's kind of right at the entrance to the glomerulus where the afferent arteriole and efferent arteriole go into and come out of the glomerulus, and the distal convoluted tubule passes right in between them. All right, but under these conditions, that juxtaglomerular apparatus secretes a molecule called renin. And renin is something that enhances the rate of this chemical reaction. So what did you learn about something that can enhance the rate of a chemical reaction? What do we call that? That's an enzyme. So renin is an enzyme. It takes angiotensinogen, and you should be able to tell me something about angiotensinogen. Tell me something about it. It's inactive, but right, there are millions of molecules in your blood just waiting to go to work. And it's turned into an active form by renin from the JG apparatus in the kidneys, and it's converted into angiotensin 1 in the blood. Angiotensin 1 has some activity, but it's not a potent kind of molecule. It has to be converted into angiotensin 2, primarily in the lungs, and I don't have that on this slide, but you should probably know that. So write that in your notes. There is another compound called ACE. And that's called angiotensin-converting enzyme. And, of course, then that means that's an enzyme that works on angiotensin 1, produces a little bit of, or produces a lot of angiotensin 2, because remember, an enzyme doesn't get used up in the chemical reaction. Now, angiotensin 2 is a very effective compound in the body. It causes vasoconstriction of arterioles. And think of a balloon. If I have a balloon and I squeeze down on a balloon that maybe has water in it or air, that's like vasoconstriction, pressing down on a balloon. What happens to the pressure in that balloon? Does it go up or down, or does it stay the same? It goes up. And if you press hard enough, what's going to happen? Well, that's going to burst, right, and you get water all over the place. Okay. So vasoconstriction as a result of angiotensin on blood vessels is going to increase blood pressure. That's one effect. The second effect is that angiotensin 2 is a signaling molecule, is a hormone, goes to the adrenal cortex, right? And in order for the adrenal cortex to modulate its activity as a result of angiotensin, what does the adrenal cortex have to have? Yeah, it's got to have a receptor, right? So a hormone has a target tissue. Target tissue is defined as a tissue that has a receptor for that particular hormone. So adrenal cortex has receptors for angiotensin 2, and when angiotensin 2 binds to those receptors on the adrenal cortex releases aldosterone. That's another hormone that goes into the blood, and it circulates everywhere that the blood circulates, including the kidneys, and the effect of aldosterone on the kidneys is to retain salt and water. So you're going to be resorbing salt as well as water from urine, and that's going to be put back into your body. What happens to blood volume when you resorb that fluid level? It goes up. Okay. So, and if blood volume goes up, Okay, think of that balloon once again. If you have that balloon and you blow a lot of air into it, what happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Does it stay the same? Does it go up or down? Or say your tire on the way home. You want to adjust the pressure in your tires. Maybe it's too low. If the pressure in your tires is too low, do you take air out or put air in? Same thing for your body, right? So if the kidneys are putting water into the cardiovascular system, does your blood pressure go up or down? It goes up, just like if the tire is on your car. All right, so if this is the response, increased blood volume, increased blood pressure, what is this loop to the stimulus? It's a nice negative feedback loop that maintains blood pressure and blood volume at the set point, right, if it's behaving properly. But in the disease state, for some reason, it's not behaving properly. And some reasons we know about, a lot of reasons we don't know why that happens when somebody has hypertension. So we can institute some therapies that work at some of these different stages, right, to control hypertension. So, for instance, a diuretic. What does a diuretic do? Makes you pee. Makes you pee. And when you lose fluid from your body, what happens to your blood volume? It goes down. All right. And when it goes down, when you take air out of a balloon, what happens to the pressure inside the balloon? It goes down. So that takes you from that hypertensive state to a normal tensive state. All right. So that's the job of a diuretic. All right. ACE inhibitors. What do you know about ACE? What can you tell me about ACE? It's an angiotensin-converting enzyme. It converts an inactive form of angiotensin into an active form, right? And if we block this stage right here, then we don't produce angiotensin II, and then aldosterone is not released, and then as a result, blood volume does not go up. If blood volume doesn't go up, what happens to your blood pressure? It starts to go down. All right, so ACE inhibitors are really nice. That's one way of treating hypertension. Then there are ARBs. An ARB is an angiotensin receptor blocker. All right, so we can, and angiotensin works after the ACE enzyme that blocks, all right, a couple of things. Vasoconstriction. If it blocks vasoconstriction, what's going to happen to blood pressure? It's going to decrease from a hypertensive state. And if we block the action of angiotensin on the adrenal cortex, aldosterone, again, won't be released, and that's going to decrease blood volume, all right? So blood pressure will go down once again. All right, but we can also work on the heart with calcium channel blockers like propranolol. We can decrease the contractility of the heart, and when that happens, your blood pressure is going to decrease as well, okay? And you might say, well, here we have a nice negative feedback loop, right? And somebody has hypertension. If we give a diuretic to decrease blood volume, right, still the set point is the same somehow in this mechanism, right, then the body is going to come up with different mechanisms to counteract the effect of this diuretic to boost the blood pressure back up. Right, so what we've learned clinically is that hypertension is resistant to treatment, and a lot of patients have to be on one or two or maybe three medications, right, in order to control their hypertension. One medication usually doesn't work, all right, but is that important? What's going to happen to the person if they don't control their hypertension? Well, yeah, they're going to die, right? So that's a really serious condition due to heart disease, kidney failure, all right, but those are just a little microcosm of what's happening all over the body. All right, so it's very important if you know anybody with hypertension that you try to support them as much as possible to get their blood pressure under control, because you know it's fatal eventually. And if a doctor has to adjust these various medications over time, it's not something that you can work out overnight or in a week or a month, right? It might take a patient months to get a handle on their hypertension. And so you have to be really supportive, especially if it's a loved one that you really care about, right? Because you know if it's not controlled that they're going to die. But can you walk up to somebody and say, you got to control your blood pressure because if you don't, you're going to die? You can. But what's going to happen to their blood pressure when you tell them that? Well, it's going to skyrocket, right? So you have to work with people, right, and work on compliance. Okay. And if you need to get involved with their physician as well, that's fine too. Okay, but you can't yell at anybody because they have hypertension. All right, so that is aldosterone and vasopressin, or ADH. There's a third hormone. What's the third hormone? Atrial-natriuretic hormone, or peptide. All right. What can you tell me about atrial? Where does this hormone come from? That comes from the heart, the atrium. All right. Natrium. What can you tell me about natrium? What's natrium? Natrium has to do with sodium, right? You know, the chemical symbol for sodium is Na, right? So this eventually is going to work with salt metabolism. When we get into the urinary chapter, we'll kind of tie that in all together. But let's talk about atrial natriuretic hormone, or peptide. All right, when you retain fluid in your body, you have expanded blood volume, and maybe if you have high blood pressure, you're going to have increased venous return to the heart. So what happens to the heart when blood returns to it and starts to fill the heart up? What happens to the heart? And it fills up. What happens to a balloon when you fill a balloon up? It expands, right? It expands. It starts to stretch. All right? And there are special stretch receptors in the left atrium. And when those stretch receptors are stimulated by increase or excessive venous return, that causes the release of atrial natriuretic hormone. All right. And natriuretic hormone inhibits aldosterone. So now you can tell me, what's the effect of AMP and aldosterone? Antagonistic or synergistic? Antagonistic. Is that a good thing? Yeah, because you should have precise control and balance over your cardiovascular system, right? Well, AMP promotes salt and water excretion to lower blood volume. All right, so if you lower blood volume, what happens to blood pressure? It's going to reduce blood pressure, right? That will reduce. So again, that shows you its antagonistic mechanism to ADH and aldosterone. But also, AMP promotes vasodilation. And when a blood vessel dilates, again, what happens to blood pressure? It's the opposite of when it constricts. When it constricts, blood pressure goes up, right? And when it dilates, blood pressure goes down. All right, so AMP is antagonistic to both aldosterone and antidiuretic hormone. All right, so you got to look at these different mechanisms right here. All right, so here is a nice flow diagram, hopefully an exam figure. I can't remember, but hopefully it is, because it's a very important mechanism. All right, so if you have increased blood volume, all right, you have increased venous return to the heart because you have more blood circulating in your cardiovascular system. And as you increase venous return, the heart is going to stretch out because it's filling up with more fluid. All right, and as the atrium stretches out, it's going to release AMP into the circulatory system. That's a hormone. And it goes to the kidney. All right, so there are receptors in the kidney that respond to AMP. And the kidney then increases salt and water excretion. All right, so that means it produces more urine volume. It gets rid of fluid, gets rid of salt. And if the volume of urine increases, what happens to blood volume? It's got to go down. All right, so how does this relate to the initial stimulus? It subtracts from it, right? So here is a mechanism that enhances, all right, that maintains homeostasis. Okay. The other thing that stretch of the left atrium does is that the stretch receptors also send information via the vagus nerve to the brain, to the posterior pituitary, to inhibit the release of ADH. Right, so stretch of the left atrium works both by increasing AMP and decreasing ADH, which both do what? They both increase the volume and the saltiness of urine, okay, which then should reduce blood pressure. So that's a pretty important mechanism. All right, so those are the hormonal mechanisms that regulate blood pressure. What's the most important of those mechanisms for adjusting long-term regulation of blood pressure? The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, and it has a lot of different steps in there that can be manipulated clinically to help people with hypertension. Okay. All right, so let's talk about some other kinds of physiology with the cardiovascular system besides the endocrine control. All right, and you're kind of familiar with this because you've done some labs already. All right, so vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue or organ. All right, because you see this equation right here. Blood flow is determined by the pressure gradient divided by the resistance. So your body can adjust the pressure, can adjust the resistance to adjust blood flow through a particular organ. And in particular, vasodilation decreases resistance and increases blood flow. Ah, what's the name of that equation that you work with in lab? Which is just blood flow equals the pressure divided by resistance. But in lab, you learned a bunch of other factors that influence resistance. What influences resistance to blood flow? Like the viscosity of the blood, which your body can't change very much. The radius of the blood vessel, which your body adjusts all the time. The length of the blood vessel is related to resistance. So if we lump all those terms into resistance right here, what's the fancy name of that equation? That's Poiseuille's law. Poiseuille, right? Poiseuille, which is French. It's not spelled anything like it's pronounced, especially the way I pronounce it. It's probably not very French at all. But nobody threw anything at me. That's good. All right, vasoconstriction does the opposite. Increases resistance and decreases blood flow. All right, so blood flow is directly related to pressure. If pressure increases, what happens to blood flow? It increases, right? So holding resistance constant, if pressure increases, blood flow increases. Now let's hold pressure constant. If resistance increases, what happens to blood flow? It goes down because it's what? Inversely related to resistance. Blood flow inversely related to resistance. Blood flow directly related to pressure. Okay. All right, so if we look through the body, we can look at blood flow, right? This is milliliters per minute through various organs in the body. We see that your kidneys are pretty small, but they require about 20% of blood flow to stay alive. Right, so that's very important. Brain, 13%. Skeletal muscles, probably if you're in an awake state, 20%. All right, and the brain, about 13%. I'm kind of surprised about that. Okay, and probably the gastrointestinal tract, 24% of your blood flow, but that's probably pretty close to being in a fed state, not a fasted state. So I would say the major organs that require blood, right, are the brain and the kidneys. I'm sorry, kidneys? Yeah, brain and the kidneys. Okay, under most conditions. All right, so the physical law that describes blood flow, okay, depends on pressure, just like when things are diffusing. What's going to make something diffuse from one place to another? A concentration gradient. How will things move by a concentration gradient? From high to low, right? And this pressure equation is pretty much the same thing, because when blood flows, how is blood going to flow? What's the motive force? It's going to not be a concentration gradient, but really a pressure gradient. So blood will flow from high pressure to low pressure. All right, so think of maybe diffusion, because you're kind of familiar with that already. Yeah, question. Oh, because they're doing so much activity. There are a lot of active transport pumps that are working all the time. So when we get to the urinary system, renal system, we'll look at all those special metabolic pumps that are working in the kidney to adjust what's in your blood and also blood volume. Yeah, it's a tremendously, it uses a lot of energy all the time. So it probably uses about 20% of the ATP in your body just to run various molecular pumps. Okay. All right, so flow through a blood vessel is going to be determined by the pressure at the beginning and the pressure at the end, and that's going to then determine, right, the amount of blood flow and the direction of the blood flow as well. Right, so the rate is directly proportional to the difference in pressure. So here we have a circulation from the left ventricle back to the right atrium. What circulation is that? What circulation is that? How many circulations do you have? You got two. What are they? pulmonary and systemic. Which one is this one right here? That's a systemic circulation, right? Okay. And we see that the pressure right at the right atrium right here is about 0 millimeters of mercury, and the pressure at the left ventricle, of course, we know it's different whether it is during, what number here? We've got 120. That's happening during what? What do we call contraction? Systole. And then we got 80, that happens during diastole. If we kind of average those together, okay, you get 100 millimeters of mercury. That's the average pressure. So the average pressure gradient through this circuit right here is what? 100 minus 0, or 100 millimeters of mercury driving blood through the systemic circulation. Okay. Alright, so here is Poiseuille's law. Right, flow is equal to the pressure gradient divided by resistance. Right, resistance is directly proportional to the length of the vessel. As the vessel gets a lot longer, the resistance goes up. And if resistance goes up, what happens to blood flow? It goes down. So in order to maintain flow, what has to happen to pressure? If resistance goes up and you want to keep blood flow the same, what has to happen to pressure? It has to go up as well, right? Which then just kind of shows you that the systemic circulation is a very high pressure circuit compared to the pulmonary circulation, because the length of blood vessels in the pulmonary circulation are very short. So they don't have the same amount of resistance, so the flow has to be the same between the right side of the heart and the left side of the heart, so the pulmonary circulation has a way reduced pressure associated with it. Right, because the resistance is also way reduced as well. Okay, resistance is inversely proportional to the fourth power rule of the radius. All right, so the diameter of a blood vessel is very important for controlling resistance and blood flow. So here's Poiseuille's law that has lumped all of these parameters together. So we got blood flow, which is what, milliliters per minute, is equal to pressure, right here, that's the pressure difference. And all the rest of these terms right here represent what? What are all these other terms? Radius, viscosity, length, and then some little numbers to make the equation make sense. What's radius, viscosity, and length right here? That's resistance, right? Okay, so as the length goes up, so does resistance. As viscosity goes up, so does resistance. But as the radius increases, what happens to resistance? You see that this resistance is inversely related? I mean, the radius is inversely related to resistance. So as the radius increases, resistance goes down. But not linearly. How does it go down? Right? If we change the radius of a blood vessel by a factor of 2, if we increase it by a factor of 2, what happens to that term? It's not just 2, it's 2 times 2. And do we stop there? It's not 4. Right? Is it 8? No, it is what? 16. All right, so small changes in resistance, in radius, small changes in radius, right, have a huge influence on the resistance to flow in that blood vessel, which means it has a huge influence on the flow as well. All right, so that's the beauty of Poiseuille's law that you have to be familiar with. The most important factor is resistance, and fortunately, okay, of all these things that determine resistance in your body, what can your autonomic nervous system control? Can it control the length of a blood vessel? No. Can't make you shorter or taller, right? Should it adjust the viscosity? Viscosity of blood really does not change. Only the radius of a blood vessel by vasodilation or vasoconstriction, and that's fortunate because that's the most powerful in adjusting blood flow through organs. So if you want to decrease blood flow through an organ, decrease blood flow, what do you need to do to the radius? Constrict it. If we want to increase blood flow through a tissue bed, we need to vasodilate. Right? And a lot of that can be done through precapillary sphincters under local control, which means what? Just the metabolic demands of the tissue that are supplied by that particular capillary bed. So here we have a plot that shows blood pressure. We got blood pressure versus a number of different places in the cardiovascular system. We have the left ventricle. And on the test, you had to know the pressure in the left ventricle. It goes from what? 0 to peak systolic pressure, about 120, whether it's in systole or diastole. And then depending on the pressure in large arteries, like the aorta, a valve might open, right? If the pressure inside the ventricle is higher than a large artery, the semilunar valve is going to open, and we get ejection of blood from the left ventricle into these large arteries. So we have a systolic pressure in large arteries as well as a diastolic when the heart is not pumping, right? So that's why we see this pulsatile nature in what? Blood pressure for the ventricle and arteries. And as blood flows into smaller and smaller arteries and arterioles, the pulsatile nature decreases, but also the mean pressure decreases until you finally get into capillaries, right? So we call these what? Exchange vessels. We're going to see why exchange takes place in there in a second, okay? And then finally blood is going to flow into venules and large veins. So a good test question is always, what type of blood vessel has the lowest pressure? And you know what a lot of students just automatically say, because it's a really important structure, exchange takes place there, students have a tendency to say capillaries have the lowest blood pressure because they're so important for exchange. But can that possibly be true? If capillaries had the lowest blood pressure, where would all the blood go? It would go to capillaries, right? And as all the blood is flowing into capillaries, what would happen to the capillaries? They get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then finally they'd burst and there'd be blood all over the place, right? It'd be an ugly mess. So blood cannot flow just into capillaries. Blood has to flow where? Back to the heart, back into veins, which means that those spaces have to have the lowest blood pressure to get blood to go back to them, right? So don't say capillary. All right, what blood vessels have the highest blood pressure? Large arteries. What blood vessels have the lowest blood pressure? Large veins, right? But we're going to still consider capillaries here for a second. Okay. We'll do it on this slide right here. So here we have a couple slides. One that shows the cross-sectional area versus a number of vascular structures like the aorta and arteries, arterioles, and capillaries. All right, and look at the dimensions of cross-sectional area. It is what? Square centimeters. That's a surface area, right? Like, how would you measure the surface area on this piece of paper? I didn't do it. I meant to calculate it. It is what?
Height times width.
It is, yeah, height times the width with 8.5 by 11 inches. That's the surface area of this piece of paper, all right? So we can measure it in centimeters if we wanted instead of square inches. And what blood vessels have the smallest cross-sectional area? Would be the aorta or vena cava. Now these are huge vessels. You can see them with your naked eye, but how many of them do you have? How many aortas do you have? You only got one. So you can actually look at the whole cross-sectional area, which is relatively small, but as blood moves from the aorta into smaller and smaller blood vessels, the diameter gets smaller, but so does the number increase, right, exponentially. So if you were to add all of the cross-sectional areas of all the arterioles together, it is what? Many, many more times. It's 2 or 3 times the cross-sectional area of the aorta. And capillaries is the highest, even though they're the smallest blood vessel. But if you were to add up the cross-sectional area, which is, you know, the width times the height of these capillaries right here, of all the millions or billions or trillions, I don't even know how many capillaries you have in your body, even though they're microscopic, if you add them all up together, that is the biggest doorway. It's the biggest cross-sectional area. And then, of course, when they anastomose into veins, and then the vena cava, the cross-sectional area goes back down. Now, you don't have to know the mathematical relationship between cross-sectional area and this term right here. You still have to appreciate the curve and know what's happening. What is centimeters per second? That's the dimension. The dimension for what? Centimeters per second is what? Centimeters per second is that flow. Is that flow? What's flow? Milliliters per minute. Or milliliters per time. What's milliliters? Centimeters what? cubed. What is this right here? Centimeters per second. That's a lot different than centimeters cubed per time. This is what? Speed. All right, so centimeters per second is speed or velocity, which is, in your car, what do you get? Do you get flow on your speedometer or do you get velocity? You get velocity, how fast you're moving, okay? All right, so here's a plot of velocity or speed versus these same cardiovascular structures. Which structure has the fastest speed? Which structure holds blood for the least amount of time? Because the speed is the highest. It is the aorta. All right? But look at what happens as a cross-sectional area increases. What happens to the speed? It is inversely related to cross-sectional area. That's just a law of physics. All right? So what part of the cardiovascular system has the highest cross-sectional area? It's capillaries. And since it's inversely related to speed, what part of the cardiovascular system has the slowest velocity or the slowest speed? Capillaries. And does that make really good sense? Yeah, because the function of capillaries is for exchange. And so you want to have blood in a capillary for a long period of time. So what can happen? Exchange. So that oxygen can leave, CO2 can go in, nutrients can go into the tissues, waste products can be taken out of the blood. Okay. So the speed through capillaries is the slowest. The speed of blood is the slowest in capillaries. All right. And why is that important? That's important because you need for blood to spend as much time as possible in capillaries for exchange to take place. Now, what other cardiovascular structures can exchange take place in? Where else can exchange take place in the cardiovascular system besides the capillary? Ah, but what's in an alveolus in terms of the cardiovascular system? There are capillaries. So the answer is, there is no other place. Okay, I tried to trick you. Okay? So capillaries are the only place where exchange can take place, and so the velocity of blood in that area has to be slow. All right. Let's talk about blood pressure. We just talked about the speed of blood, blood pressure. And let me erase the board right here. So you see how blood pressure is... What is blood pressure related to in your body? Where do you see pressure on the board right here? It's equal to blood flow. I mean, it's directly related to blood flow, but it's inversely related to resistance. Okay. So the slide that I want to go to next to talk about these various things right here is this one. So I skipped a couple slides. And if you understand this slide, it will help you with every other slide for blood pressure. All right, so blood pressure is controlled mainly by heart rate. You probably have a pretty good inherent feeling of what heart rate is, right? If you want to measure heart rate, how do you do it? Well, you just take somebody's central pulse or radial pulse or pedal pulse and count how many times your heart beats per minute. Stroke volume, a little bit tougher. Stroke volume is what? The amount, not quite cardiac output. It's the amount of blood that's pumped from the heart every time it does what? Every time it beats, one time. Beats one time, pumps blood out, that's stroke volume. And then peripheral resistance is just the resistance to blood flow in peripheral blood vessels. So just think of it as resistance. So I want you to get a good inherent feeling that blood pressure is controlled by heart rate, stroke volume, and peripheral resistance. It's not intuitive unless we work with these two equations right here. All right, so what are the units of blood flow once again? Milliliters per minute, that's a flow. That's equal to pressure divided by the resistance. All right, then we got cardiac output. What are the units of cardiac output? Milliliters per minute. It looks a lot like what? Blood flow. All right, but how did you learn cardiac output? It is stroke volume times heart rate. All right, so stroke volume times heart rate can be equated with what? Pressure divided by resistance. That's a nice, simple mathematical equation. So we got pressure. Can you see my marker? It's kind of dying away. Pressure divided by resistance is equal to what? stroke volume times heart rate. Okay. Now, I don't like this resistance over here on this side of the equation. What can we do to get it on the other side? Because I'm interested in blood pressure. Multiply by both sides of the equation by R. All right, so if we multiply both sides of the equation by R, that's resistance, what happens? That R goes away, and we've got what? Pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times resistance. So pressure is what? Directly related to stroke volume. If stroke volume goes up, what happens to pressure? It goes up. If heart rate increases, what happens to pressure? It goes up. If resistance increases, what happens to pressure? It goes up because it's directly related, right? So this equation right here is not so intuitive, but you saw how we derived it, so hopefully you'll get a little intuitive sense that resistance is important for blood pressure. Right, so we just come up with this statement. It's controlled mainly by heart rate, stroke volume, and peripheral resistance, which is just R in my equation right there. Okay, and how are they related? Directly related. Right, okay. So, an increase in any one of these results in an increase in blood pressure. Do you agree with that? Yeah, it has to work that way. All right, so sympathoadrenal activity raises blood pressure via arterial vasoconstriction. All right, and by increased cardiac output. Well, what does vasoconstriction do? What happens to resistance? Let's analyze this a little bit. Increase in sympathoadrenal activity raises blood pressure by vasoconstriction. What happens to resistance when you vasoconstrict? Resistance increases. What happens to blood pressure? It increases. What's the other activity? And by increased cardiac output. Stimulate the heart with sympathetic innervation. Both the heart rate increases. The stroke volume increases because it goes where? It goes to the SA node. It also goes to the ventricular myocardium. It increases contractility. And if you increase both heart rate and stroke volume, increase both stroke volume and heart rate, what happens to pressure? It increases as well. Okay? So make sure you jot that equation down and probably practice deriving it. So on a test, if something isn't making sense, just take a deep breath. Right, and derive that equation and you should be able to figure out what's going on. All right, the kidney plays a role in blood pressure by regulating blood volume. All right, and if blood volume increases, venous return increases, and what happens to the strength of contraction as the ventricle starts to stretch? Okay, what happens to stroke volume as the heart starts to stretch out? And you got to know why that is. So as venous return increases, the heart stretches and it gets stronger. What's the mechanism that you use to explain why the heart gets stronger as the ventricles get stretched out a little bit? That's that length-tension relationship. It's called, what's it called? Ah, thank you. Starling's law. Right? So contractility increases, so stroke volume goes up. Right? And when stroke volume goes up, so does pressure as a result. Okay? As a result of increasing blood volume working through venous return. All right, so there's a lot on this slide. Make sure that you can appreciate those different salient points, right? Probably by deriving that equation right there. All right, so what's the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure? The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, right, which is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about something that's more immediate. And what we see on the overhead projector right here is the most important mechanism for short-term regulation in blood pressure. So that when you change body position or presented with a stressful stimulus, all of a sudden you don't lose blood pressure and then lose consciousness, all right? And that's called the baroreceptor reflex. All right, so when you think of regulation of blood pressure, you should think of two domains, long-term and short-term. Long-term is the renin-angiotensin mechanism, and short-term is the baroreceptor reflex. Okay, it's activated by changes in blood pressure. What do we call a change in blood pressure in terms of a response loop? What is that called? That's a stimulus, right? So a response loop is going to be initiated by some kind of change in blood pressure. And in order for you to detect a change in blood pressure, what does your body need? What's the second step in a response loop? A receptor. And those are what we call baroreceptors. A barometer is something that measures pressure. Whether you're a weatherman or a physiologist, baro has to do with pressure. And that's because of somebody that studied pressure, a physicist way back when, right? That was Signor Bar. I don't know where he's from. Maybe Italy. I'm not sure. What's Bar? Is that Italian or German? I have no clue. You could Google it. Let me know. All right, so where do you have baroreceptors? All right, they're located in two areas, the arch of the aorta as well as the carotid sinus. Point to your aortic arch. Where's your aortic arch? Where's your carotid sinus? Don't press too hard because I don't want you to pass out. Your carotid sinus is right here. It's right at the bifurcation of the common carotid into the what? External carotid and internal. Where does the external carotid take blood to? External. Where does it take blood to? External. Takes it to your face and your tongue, everything outside the cranial vault. Not very important. Compared to, where does the internal carotid artery take blood? Your brain, into the cranial vault, and you have consciousness only for a matter of seconds if you cut off blood supply to the brain, right? Much more important than blood to your face, but I don't want to give away blood flow anywhere to my head, right? But especially the brain. Okay, so there are baroreceptors in the arch and the carotid sinus that can monitor pressure, systemic pressure, not pulmonary pressure, but systemic pressure, right? And increased blood pressure does what to the walls of these arteries? You blow into a balloon, increase the pressure, they're going to stretch. So that sends action potentials, an increasing frequency of action potential as these vessels stretch, right, to the brain. And in particular, the medulla oblongata. So in the medulla oblongata, we have the vasomotor center and the cardiac control center, or sometimes we call it the cardioregulatory center, can run around by different names, but nonetheless, they're in the medulla. All right, so what do we call the vasomotor center and the cardioregulatory center in the medulla in terms of a response loop? That is the integration center. It's going to integrate information from the arch, right, and the carotid sinus. And what is it going to do with that information? What does an integration center have? It's got a value. What is that value? Set point. And what is the value? What the normal blood pressure should be, right? So it takes information from the receptor, compares it to the set point, and if the numbers are exactly the same, then the medulla doesn't have to make a decision on what to do because everything's perfect. But if there's a difference, there's an error, the medulla has to make a decision on what to do. If your blood pressure's low, it's got to make a decision to do what? Boost it back up. Or if your blood pressure's high, lower it back down. Okay. All right, so the medulla is most sensitive to decrease and sudden changes in blood pressure, like when you're sitting down and stand up. Your blood pressure is going to drop due to a change in body position. All right, so as your blood pressure is dropping, guess what might happen to your heart? How would you want to increase blood pressure? What can you do? Look at some things that are directly related to it, namely what? Stroke volume and heart rate. So your heart's going to speed up, and the sympathetic activity to the heart is going to increase stroke volume, which is going to boost your blood pressure up. All right, so that's how the baroreceptor reflex works. But let's look at these different structures right here. Here's the medulla. Here's the cardioregulatory center in the medulla. And it's going to receive information from baroreceptors in the arch and the carotid sinus right here. These come in the afferent pathway. Yes, this is the afferent pathway. I'm trying to remember which one is which. I think this one right here is the vagus nerve, and this is the hypoglossal nerve coming into the cardioregulatory center, which controls the set point. And for instance, if the blood pressure is increasing, what would we want to do to the heart? What would be the, well, what's the decision that the medulla is going to make if your blood pressure is starting to go up? If blood pressure is going up, if that's the stimulus, we want to do what? we want it to go back down, what are we going to do? Decrease heart rate. All right, and that can be accomplished by the parasympathetic stimulation through the vagus nerve to the SA node and AV node, because that's the only place where parasympathetic nerves go. Right, that slows the heart rate, that decreases blood pressure. But let's just say now that the stimulus is an increase in blood pressure. No, that's what we just talked about. Let's just say that the stimulus is a decrease in blood pressure. How does your body want to compensate? Increase blood pressure. How can you increase blood pressure? Increasing stroke volume and heart rate right here. So we have the medulla making a decision to send out sympathetic activity via these sympathetic nerves to the conduction system of the heart to increase heart rate. What kind of effect on the heart do we call that? What are two ways we can adjust cardiac output? Through chronotropy and inotropy. So if we're adjusting heart rate, which one of those effects is that? That's chronotropy, right? So the sympathetic nerves will be a positive chronotropic effect on the heart, right? But it also goes to the ventricle, because, well, it just goes there, because that's the anatomy of it. Then it will have a positive inotropic effect on the heart as well. So sympathetic activity increases both stroke volume and heart rate. So how does that affect pressure? Since they're directly related, that will increase pressure, blood pressure, right? So that's a nice negative feedback loop. Who's got a question on that? Oh, when you do karate massage. Okay, I kind of like that. You know, I'm not sure I've ever heard of that manipulation. Okay, I'm not sure I'm familiar with that, but karate, we can work through this mechanism right here. But, for instance, karate massage is massaging your neck, and you have the carotid baroreceptors and the carotid sinus, so you're stimulating those receptors, so the information going to your brain is saying, when you start to stretch that carotid sinus is what? Your blood pressure is going way up. All right, so you're sending a signal to the brain saying that your blood pressure is going way up, kind of artificially, just by manipulating those carotid receptors. So what's the response of the medulla? When it understands your blood pressure is going way up, even though it's not really changing, you're just kind of giving it some false information by massage. All right, medulla thinks your blood pressure is going way up. What's the decision the medulla is going to do? Yeah, it's going to slow your heart rate down, okay, and that should lower your blood pressure just by an artificial manipulation of the carotid sinus. Now, was that kind of what? Okay, that's totally what's happening there. That's cool, which is the reason why I said when I asked you to point to your aortic arch, go ahead, point to it, and point to your carotid sinus, but don't push too hard, because what could happen? If you push really hard, hard enough, your medulla is going to think your blood pressure is skyrocketing. It could actually slow your heart down so much that you might pass out. And I don't want to see anybody passing out in here. I don't hate to see when the student's head bounces off the table and then the chair and then the floor. That happens in labs sometimes when we did physiology experiments. Okay? All right, so that can happen, and that might readjust the feedback control mechanism if you do that manipulation. I don't know clinically if that's effective for long-term regulation or short-term regulation, but it's kind of interesting that that can happen. Right, and of course, that's the basis of various kinds of chokeholds and martial arts and things like that, right? Like sleeper holds and things like that. Okay. But of course, you never want to occlude somebody's airway for a long period of time, because of course, that would be fatal. Just by massage, you probably can't kill anybody with the carotid arteries, but if you're doing surgery on somebody's neck near those baroreceptors and you're messing around pulling and tugging on tissue like we did in anatomy lab, you might be able to stimulate the baroreceptors enough to actually seize somebody's heart. So that can be important clinically if you're doing surgery, for instance, and in which case then you need to anesthetize that vagus nerve so it doesn't carry the information to the medulla. Okay. All right, so here is a good exam figure. So what can we say about this figure right here? It's on the test, or chances are it's on the test. Why? Why would you say this might be on the test? What do we call that? That's a response loop, and in particular, what response loop is that? It's the baroreceptor reflex, and is that important?
Yes.
Why? Tell me why. It's the most important for short-term regulation in blood pressure, which you cannot live without, right? Unless you're going to be lying in bed all day. All right, which we don't. Okay, so going from a lying down position to standing position, blood is going to have a tendency to pool in your extremities because you're changing body position. All right, so what happens to return of blood flow to the heart if blood is pooling in your extremities when you change body position? What about venous return? Well, if it's stuck in your peripheral blood vessels, it's not going back to your heart, so venous return does what? It goes down, right? Venous return goes down. And as venous return goes down, not as much blood is filling the heart up, so what happens to the force of contraction of the heart? It goes down, and you could explain that by what? The Frank-Starling law of the heart, right? End-diastolic volume goes down, the heart loses contractility, right? So end-diastolic volume, oh, I said it right there. End-diastolic volume goes down, and because of the Frank-Starling law of the heart, what happens to stroke volume? It goes down, so what happens to blood pressure? It goes down as well, right? Because pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times resistance. All right, so cardiac output goes down, and then we see that blood pressure decreases as a result. So that's, let's start there as being the stimulus for the baroreceptor reflex, because you have baroreceptors. What are the two areas? Arch and sinus, right? Make sure you know where those two are. Right, and via the afferent pathway goes to the medulla oblongata, in particular the cardioregulatory center. And blood pressure is going down, so what's the decision made by that integration center? Right, compares it to a set point, there's an error, what are we going to do? Increase sympathetic activity, decrease parasympathetic activity, that's the decision. So if we increase sympathetic activity to arterioles, it causes vasoconstriction. As arterioles vasoconstrict, what happens to resistance? It increases, and as resistance increases, what happens to pressure? Damn, that's amazing. Okay, that's pretty nice. All right? That's actually pretty cool physiology right here. This is not really elementary type physiology, right? So as total peripheral resistance increases, your blood pressure goes up. How did that correspond to the initial stimulus? Subtracts from it, so what kind of feedback loop is that? Nice negative feedback loop maintaining homeostasis. Okay, but as we increase sympathetic activity and decrease parasympathetic activity, what happens to the heart? It increases heart rate, right? It also increases, because it goes to the ventricular myocardium, it increases heart rate and stroke volume, which does what to blood pressure? It increases blood pressure. So how does that correspond to the initial stimulus? Subtracts from it. So again, that maintains blood pressure at within normal range, right? So that maintains homeostasis and prevents you from going into a disease state and even contusing your head into a nasty mess, right? So that is the baroreceptor reflex, right? So make sure you can follow each one of these steps in here because it is so important. Okay, so that's it for this chapter, unless you want me to entertain some questions. Questions from anybody? Yeah. Oh, I skipped over a slide? Okay, so I skipped. Tell me, where should I go from here? Further? This one right here. Oh, I skipped this one. Oh, you're right. Okay. Thank you. Thanks for reminding me. I did skip this one, and maybe this one right here. Yeah, let's go over this one. Okay. So this has to do with blood pressure, but now since you know something about blood pressure, it will be pretty easy to understand this figure right here. All right, so let me just make it a little bit bigger. Pointer option. Oh, I'm glad you reminded me to go back to this one. All right. So this is almost like an experiment that you did in lab. All right, so here we have maybe a plastic tube, a set of plastic tubes that we can change the diameter on by adjusting this little thumb screw, right? We can constrict or dilate this blood vessel right here. All right, so if we constrict it, what happens to resistance? If we constrict, what happens to resistance? Does it go up or down? Yeah, it goes up. Okay, and if we dilate it, the resistance goes down. All right, so we're going to be pouring fluid in. This is like the heart pumping blood into the aorta. All right, so if we pour a lot of fluid in here, as this column rises up, that increases the pressure. Right, so the height kind of represents the pressure. All right, so for instance, if we turn this thumb screw to vasoconstrict, thereby increasing resistance, what happens to pressure in these tubes right here? It increases. All right, so does that kind of follow this equation right here? If we increase vascular resistance, the pressure increases. What? Before the resistance, not after it, but before the resistance, the pressure increases. All right, and as this pressure increases, then blood flow is going to go through these organs right here. All right, and it's going to then decrease blood flow through these organs over here. So maybe we could say these are skeletal muscles, and this is the digestive tract. For instance, when you're in a fasted state, we don't need blood flow going to the digestive tract. We need blood flow going to muscles. So there will be vasoconstriction going to the digestive tract. But when you're in a fed state, you need blood flow going to the digestive tract. So guess what's going to happen to this vasoconstriction right here? It's going to go away, right? And then blood flow can go to the digestive tract, but blood flow is still going to be maintained to the skeletal system, but what's going to happen? The pressure is going to decrease, and neither organs will receive the proper amount of blood flow. So in a fed state, if we want blood flow going to the digestive tract, what do we have to do to blood flow going to these vessels right here, going to the skeletal system, muscles? We need to vasoconstrict these to maintain blood pressure right here. We really don't have enough blood in our body to go everywhere at one time. Your body's got to pick and choose where it goes to, okay? And it does so by what? Vasodilation or vasoconstriction at various points in the cardiovascular system. Okay, and I know my mom was pretty smart, because after lunch, if I wanted to go into the pool, municipal pool, what would she say? No, of course not, because you're going to cramp and die. And why is that? Because you don't have enough blood flow to go everywhere in your body, your digestive tract and skeletal muscles at the same time. Okay. All right, so blood flow. Capillary blood flow is low because of the large cross-sectional area. So here we have a plot of the cross-sectional area of these various kinds of blood vessels, like the aorta, right, arteries, and then capillaries right here. And what we see, and now this is not the speed, this is pressure. The biggest change in area, the cross-sectional area, is in these arterioles. And so that's where we see the biggest change in blood pressure, because that's where the resistance changes the most. Now, how do you think about a resistance of a blood vessel? What's the most important term for resistance in a tube? Remember Poiseuille's law? Is what? What term? What term goes into resistance right here? You got the length, which doesn't really change very much, right? It's a radius, right? And so the biggest change in radius happens at the level of arterioles, and that's where we see the biggest change in resistance, which then corresponds to pretty much the biggest change in pressure, is through those arterioles. All right, so that's those two slides. Okay? Okay, and then you all know this one right here. That's not intuitive, but make sure you can derive the equation that shows that pressure is directly related to heart rate, stroke volume, and resistance. All right, then you're going to be really good for the test. All right, so that takes us to our next chapter, which is respiratory system. All right, so I can get started with respiratory system a little bit right here. We got about a half hour left in class. Okay. Respiratory structures. All right, so hang in there. Don't leave. You'll get in trouble if you leave early. Okay. The functions of the respiratory system. Let me get my arrow options going here once again. Okay, respiration. We spent probably 2 weeks on respiration already. What do you know about respiration? Tell me something about respiration. Breathing, okay. But we didn't study breathing yet. We studied another part of respiration. We called it cellular respiration. What was that? How you make ATP from oxygen and other kinds of nutrients, like glucose. Or if you want to consider fatty acids, that's fine with me too. How do you make ATP from fatty acids? Beta oxidation. Really good. Okay. And you probably know a number of different ways of making ATP from glucose. What are the two main ways? You got aerobic and anaerobic, right? And you kind of know where in the cells those take place, all that kind of stuff, right? So think about that. All right, so the three related functions, you got ventilation, which is breathing in and out. It has nothing to do with cellular respiration, which is what? Biochemical pathways. But ventilation is just breathing in and out. And then you've got gas exchange. Where does that happen? Capillaries. Two sets of capillaries. Capillaries in the lungs and then capillaries in various other parts of the body, right? Pulmonary circulation versus systemic circulation. And then you've got O2 utilization, and we call that cellular respiration. So all of these things kind of get lumped into respiration. And that's where the lungs get dragged into this discussion because of the ventilation part of it. All right, so ventilation moves air in and out of the lungs for gas exchange in the what circulation? Pulmonary circulation. We call that external respiration. All right, and then we got gas exchange between blood and tissues. What circulation does that happen in? Systemic circulation. We might want to call that internal respiration. And gas exchange in every single circumstance is passive. What does that mean? It's passive. It can only go from high concentration to low concentration. So oxygen can only go from where it's high to where it's low. All right, so where is oxygen concentration the lowest? Around tissues or in the air? In the air or around tissues? How do you want oxygen to go? You want oxygen to go in. So where does it have to be high? It's got to be high in the air, low inside your body, and if it weren't, oxygen would never go in. All right, that's a little counterintuitive because you think you need oxygen so much, and of course you do, but it's low in your body, so oxygen just moves in because that's the only way it can move in. It's just that physical chemistry principle that we call diffusion. All right, now what about CO2? Do you want to retain CO2 or would you like to eliminate it from your body? Yeah, because it's a waste product. So where is CO2 low, inside your body or in the air? It's got to be low in the air, otherwise CO2 would never leave your body. And indeed, CO2 in the atmosphere around here is is almost close to zero. So there's a huge concentration gradient for getting rid of CO2 from your body, right? Because it will only diffuse from high to low. All right, so here are some respiratory structures that you know from anatomy, right? This is the lower respiratory tract. Well, don't forget the larynx is part of the lower respiratory tract as well. You've got the trachea. Is it normally closed or normally open? Is normally open. Why is it normally open? Because of the cartilage. As a matter of fact, it's always open. It can't close, right? And that's really a good thing, but it could be a bad thing. Why could that be a bad thing? Because all you got to do is put something over the trachea here and let it go, and what's going to happen to it? It's going to fall right in there, and then that trachea is obstructed, and you're not going to live very long if you have an obstructed trachea. But hopefully, you're going to be around somebody that knows what? A Heimlich maneuver or CPR certified, right? All right, then the trachea will bifurcate into primary bronchi, right? Then tertiary bronchi, smaller and smaller bronchi, going to the various lobes of the lung and then lobules. And then finally, you get to terminal bronchioles, which are microscopic. They no longer contain cartilage. They can contain smooth muscle. So now we go from the conducting zone, which contains cartilage, to the respiratory zone, which does not contain cartilage. But the respiratory zone also contains a vast network of capillaries around these structures as well. So what can happen in the respiratory bronchioles and these little sacs right here that we call alveoli? Exchange can take place, right? So that's why we call that the respiratory zone. Okay, you have about 8 million alveolar sacs and about 300 million alveoli in your lungs. And so that is the surface area for exchange. So when I say surface area for exchange, what I want you to know is, in everyday language, surface area for exchange in one word? How would you tell me about surface area for exchange in one word? Here I have a meter stick, kind of like a yardstick, but it's a meter. All right, and how do you measure the surface area of something? It's the width times the height. I think we did this in this class already. I can't remember for sure. But here is a I'm in a node. Okay, so I stepped out of the node, had to turn, no, I'm still in the node, but I turned the microphone off. So here is a doorway. We could measure the cross-sectional area of this doorway. What's the cross-sectional area of this doorway right here? I got a ruler. It is how wide? It's 1 meter wide. And how tall is it? That's all we need to do to calculate surface area. So here's 1 meter, and what's this? Oh, it's exactly 2. That's fortunate, because that makes the calculation really easy. What's the surface area of that doorway? Yeah, it's 1 times 2, or 2 square meters. All right? All right, so how many people can go through that doorway at one time? Maybe 2, 3, something like that. All right? So 2 square meters, maybe about 2 people can go through it. But now let's just say it's the door on your garage that your car goes through. What's the surface area of that door? Is it 2 square meters or a lot more? That's a lot more. So how many people can get through that doorway? A lot more. Maybe 10 times as many. Maybe 10 people, 20 people, right? So as the surface area for exchange takes place, then the rate of exchange increases as well, right? It's directly related to each other. So the doorway for exchange, because we have 300 million alveoli, is about 70 square meters. So if we were to take all 300 million alveoli, peel them kind of like a grape or an orange peel, and lay them flat on a table, the table would have to be as big as half of a tennis court, 70 square meters. So that's the surface area of exchange for oxygen entering and CO2 leaving your blood. And is that a big doorway or small doorway? That's huge. And evolution has figured out a way to take that huge doorway and fold it up and stick it inside your lungs. And I think, personally, I find that very appealing, because I can't imagine being as wide as a tennis court and half as tall, right, to have just a flat membrane right there. So it's really nice that that's all folded in there. All right, and so that means that the structural place where exchange happens in the lung is really this alveolus right here, because it provides the surface area. Okay, so if we look inside an alveolus, this is what it looks like. Okay, here we have some connective tissue. Here we have a capillary. And what can you tell me about the structure of this capillary right here? Is it thick or thin? It's thin, because you know something about this epithelium. What is this epithelium? It's a simple squamous epithelium. It's lining a blood vessel, so we don't call it an epithelium. We call it an endothelium, but basically it's just a simple squamous epithelium. And simple squamous is specialized for exchange, because diffusion can't take place if something is thick, right? It takes a long time. All right, so here is the lining of an alveolus, right? And what can you tell me about this epithelium? Simple squamous epithelium, specialized for exchange, right? Now, there are a couple different kinds of cells that make up an alveolus. There is a type 1, which I see right here, which is the simple squamous. Then there's a type 2 alveolar cell, whose job is not for exchange, because it's way too thick. The job of this guy is to secrete something called surfactant. And we're going to talk about that maybe right now. And then here's a macrophage, which was a monocyte in the blood at one time. But remember, monocytes are shapeshifters. They can crawl around all over the body. They can crawl in and out of capillaries. And these guys crawl around inside all of these alveoli looking for junk that doesn't belong there, like bacteria, fungi, viruses, and things like that that help prevent pneumonia. Okay. So, let me talk a little bit about surfactant, which is secreted by this alveolar type 1 cell right here. All right, so let's think about the properties of water in particular. Is water a slippery substance, or is it a sticky substance? You all know that it's kind of sticky. Now, if it's on the floor, you got to worry about slipping. But you should know it's sticky, and why? because of hydrogen bonding. Go all the way back to the chemistry principles that we were first looking at in this class, right? So water is definitely sticky, and we'll do a really quick experiment right here. So here I have like two membranes. These are just some acetates, and right now I don't have any glue between them. They're just dry. So if I put them together like this, and I hold one, and I have you pull on the bottom one, they just fall right apart, right? Because there's no glue. As a matter of fact, if I just hold one and let go of the other, right, it just falls right out. No problem. But let's put some glue. What could we use for glue? We could use water because of that hydrogen bond right here. All right, so let's put some water on there. Okay. And now I got glue, which is basically just tap water, right? All right, so if I hold one and let the other one go, it does what? They're stuck together. More importantly, if you pull, okay, you pull on this one, which is different than the one I'm holding on, are they really kind of stuck together? Tremendous amount, okay? They're really stuck, okay? Once you get them going, maybe not so bad. I know some people I can almost lift right up out of their chair if I pull just right. Okay, so you grab the bottom corner. Oh, it was a lot of force. I didn't quite lift you out of there, but anyway, I tried. All right, so because of hydrogen bonding, water is really sticky. We call that surface tension. Water molecules stick together, and as a matter of fact, you've probably seen insects that can actually walk right on the surface of water because they're so light they can't push the water molecules apart and go kaplunk in there. All right, now here we have a microscopic structure, this alveolus, and inside the lungs, of course, there is water. That's the fluid inside our bodies. And if there was just water, guess what would happen to this alveolus right here? They would stick together, and that alveolus could never inflate. So there should be air inside this alveolus right here. And so in order to defeat surface tension, okay, there has to be a detergent that's made by your body called surfactant, which then breaks those hydrogen bonds between the water molecules and allows alveoli to inflate. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, that's absolutely necessary, right, in order for exchange to take place. So that's the job of this alveolar type 2 cell right here. Okay. All right, so I think next time we're going to start maybe here at thoracic cavity. I don't even know if I need to talk about these things. Read these slides right here. You should know this from anatomy. All right, so I'm going to start with thoracic cavity next time. Oh, I got a question for you. So when I say surface area for exchange, what's that one word in English that you should be thinking of automatically? What's the one word? Well, I should put this on the test. Doorway. Extra credit point. I like that, right? We measure the surface area of that door right there. Oh, yeah? All the time, yeah. Well, I was thinking at first.